CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Mongolia, a landlocked country that bordering China, bordering Russia, has a lot of answers, or at least partial answers, of the state of Eurasia right now in wartime. I welcome Antonia Kalabashanu for Geopolitical Futures, a subscription site. She is in Bucharest, writing about Mongolia as representative of a number of so-called buffer states around China and once upon a time around the Soviet Union, and what we can see of their response to the pandemic, to the war, to the demand for resources, to worldwide inflation. Antonia, a very good day to you in Bucharest. Thank you very much. What is striking about Mongolia is that it is natural resource rich. Chiefly, you write about coal, but I know they have lots of lumber and uranium and all the extractive resources that we hear about on the earth. And yet, who is in charge in Mongolia? Is it Beijing? Is it Moscow? Can we tell? Good evening to you.
Hello, good evening. Thank you for having me, first of all. And it is always a pleasure to be here with you discussing such interesting and worrisome news, because indeed Mongolia is one of the buffer zones in between Russia and China at the moment. And it is telling for both the Chinese economy and the Russian war. It is telling in terms of global economy, in terms of instability of the world. Like, all Eurasia is pretty much in a nutshell in Mongolia right now. As for who is in charge, well, currently, Mongolia is very much dependent on China, because they are the ones who have invested much in Mongolia extractive industries, and they are the ones who are buying a lot of coal from Mongolia. However, the food and the energy, which is electricity and petroleum, is coming from Russia. So they are dependent on one side when it comes to exports to China, and dependent on Russia when it comes to their imports. And they're very, specific imports. You know, we're talking energy and food, which are very much needed for keeping the population stable and keeping the economy stable. So it is a balancing act, and not to mention that currently Mongolia is also taking in a lot of, thousands, they're reporting thousands of Russians running away from conscription in Russia. So that is also one thing that is putting pressure on the Mongolian economy. And at the same time, the government has tried to detach itself from the war and basically stayed a bit more silent than anyone else in Central Asia, in hope that that is going to make it easier for Mongolia to attract some more investments into a certain pipeline that is linking China to Russia. So it is the node. It is one node in Eurasia.
Let us look deeper into Mongolia, because you begin your essay noting that there is a fraud trial pending within next days. $12 billion of coal is missing, telling me that neither Beijing nor Moscow know especially where it is, although this is the way you do business. You divert some of it for your own team. That investigation, however, you write, has caused protest in the streets, I take it, of Ulaanbaatar, the capital. And that kind of disorder, is that unusual in Mongolia? Are we looking at a symptom of some deeper cause?
Well, protests are not necessarily something odd in Mongolia. So they do happen. Mongolia is a democracy. The problem is when, you know, it is a democracy when it comes to voting, right? The problem is that the current government is pretty much opaque, and Mongolians basically have complained that things are not going well with the country. And one of the reasons things are not going well with the country is the corrupt personnel in the government. However, when they took the streets, some other elements of wariness have come out of the protests. So people are telling that, in fact, they're living loan to loan, and that the inflation is not something that they can bear anymore. So it is, on one side, it is a corruption, which is clearly a phenomenon, and it is clearly something that has drove these protests into the market. And, you know, they are facing freezing cold temperatures that we could not, probably I could not face, at least. So, but at the same time, it is the very poor state of the economy that is keeping these people out there and demanding that the government do something about, does something at least about this scandal. And pretty much going into the trial, the people are, the population is demanding that you have something to address, like the government needs to address the real problems of the economy and address their, you know, very basic problems, which have to do with inflation, with the price of energy, with the price of food and so on.
Is there food insecurity? Have you heard stories of people not having enough to eat?
It is not that they are not having enough to eat. It is that it is not affordable to buy food, which is, you know, pretty much the same for many people. Also, we are talking about a country that is having the population concentrated in the main capital. So 2/3 of the population is living in the capital. So it's an urban setting, which means that you cannot really have your own food, even if you have, you know, some patch of land. And that pretty much is not doable, considering that you're in an urban setting and you probably have a job to go to. So
what we have here then is a country that is destabilized by worldwide inflation, by the war, and by this balancing act between two hostile powers. What is striking about your essay is you now take this model and go to Laos, to Myanmar, to Nepal, and Bhutan to look at the buffer states around China. And each of them, in turn, seem to have similar stories and problems to Mongolia: inflation, wartime, and what is called the debt trap engineered by China before the pandemic. How does the debt trap work, Antonia?
Well, basically, China tried to make inroads into these countries for various reasons, like having a spot to go through, for instance, a land route to go through into the Indian Ocean when it comes to Myanmar, or having ports that they can use in Sri Lanka, for instance, or having some posturing when it comes to its relationship to India, and therefore use Bhutan and Nepal for doing so. So they've lended money, they've promised, they made a lot of promises, and this process has not been very transparent, something that is, you know, it is what it is when you are dealing with China. You're not going to get much transparency in return. And you're also not sure on what exactly you're going to be able to build when you're talking about infrastructure or any kind of project that has to do with the Chinese money and the Chinese workforce, which means that these countries are highly indebted. With the pandemic, even if they have built something, they couldn't really make use of it because of the lockdown policies that China has imposed and went with it in 2022. And they see themselves trapped. They need to pay back their loans. They have no way to pay back their loans because their economy went down during the last 3 years, considering that their economies were also in many cases dependent on the Chinese economy in terms of you know, they either had to export merchandise to China, or they had to use the routes to get their merchandise out of the world, routes that they couldn't use because of the lockdown policies. So all in all, they've been kind of trapped into working with China. And this meant that they had to produce during these years in order to pay back some of the loans they've gotten from China, which they cannot do right now. And at the same time, China is not in a position to say, well, I don't really need the money right now. I need a strategic posture. We don't know exactly what the economic problems of China are, but we know for sure that the Chinese economy did not grow during 2022. And because of the zero COVID policy, there was a slowdown. And we don't fully grasp what the slowdown really meant, because again, there is not a lot of transparency when we are talking about the Chinese society and the Chinese economy. So with that, we're having a Beijing that is somewhat needing the backup for, you know, buying time in a sense. And it is also appearing to need the money, some of the money that it gave to these countries, part of the so-called Belt and Road Initiative.
Right.
And it cannot get it.
Well, let's go through the countries. Laos doesn't have the money. They have all this money for railway lines and hydropower plants, but they don't have the money to service the loans. Myanmar, you report that 40% of the population is living under the poverty line. That is not exactly in a position to pay back. And then we come to Nepal, which you say has a liquidity crunch, but in addition to that, it's a small state, and the pandemic scarred it. Bhutan, the same story. Now, what I get is that China's Belt and Road has turned into a series of beggar nations around China, and China becomes a beggar nation. Is that the way to regard this? We don't trust the numbers out of Beijing, but we do know that they need their money back and it's not coming.
Exactly. So it's instability that we are seeing out of China and China's economy. And it is higher instability from these countries surrounding China that is pretty much unable to cope with the demands. They are unable to cope with the demands of their own population, let alone Chinese demands. So Laos, for instance, is trying to balance China by building relationships with Vietnam, or supporting relationships that it already had with Vietnam and Japan. Nepal and Bhutan are trying to look to India, but they're fragile economies. Right. So, these fragile economies cannot really give the money back to China, which is also turning into a fragile economy itself, only that we don't know exactly how fragile.
As winter begins, Antonia Colubashanu, reporting for Geopolitical Futures. He's an analyst. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.